Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 316 for May 15th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
At the end of it all, I'm a dinosaur. I'm the end of my line.
That's John Ryan, the last of seven generations of whiskey distillers in Ireland's Powers family. He was around for the end of distilling at the old Powers Distillery in Dublin and traveled the world for Irish distillers. He'll share some of his stories with us later on. I'll also have the calendar of events and the emails of the week. First off, let's look at the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Lots of new whiskies to mention this week. Val Blair's 1995 vintage will make its debut at a travel retail industry show in Singapore this coming week. It'll initially be available only in the Asia-Pacific region at first. Glendronach is releasing a new 15-year-old expression finished in tawny port casks. 1,000 cases will be available in 20 export markets and at whiskey retailers in the UK, as well as the distillery shop. Auchentoshan is releasing a 1998 vintage that was matured exclusively in Pheno sherry casks. It's bottled at a cask strength 54.6% ABV. And Canadian whiskey fans will get a 30-year-old expression of Alberta Premium starting in June. The long-gone 25-year-old version of Alberta Premium used to get rave reviews. I still have a bottle of it on my shelf. Meanwhile, if you haven't already ordered a bottle of the Spirit of Unity malt bottled to benefit earthquake relief efforts in Japan, it's too late to order them in Scotland. Both Loch Fyne Whiskies and Royal Mile Whiskies have sold out of their allocations. Ewan Mitchell of Isle of Arran says the whiskey is now scheduled for bottling this week at Glendronach's Bottling Hall and will be shipped as soon as possible. All proceeds from the Spirit of Unity bottling will go to Refugees International Japan and will go to help rebuild communities in the area affected by the earthquake and tsunami in March. Now, some of this whiskey will also be sent to Whiskey Galore in Christchurch, New Zealand, and to several retailers in Japan. You might still be able to get a bottle through them. Two competitions to mention. The Spirit of Speyside Festival's annual awards were handed out following blind judging by guests at the festival's opening dinner at Knockando Distillery. Aberlour Abuna took top honors for single malts 12 years old and younger. The Glenlivet 18 won for single malts between 13 and 20 years old. And the Glenfiddich 30 won the award for malts over 20 years old. Next year's Spirit of Speyside Festival will be held from May 3rd through the 7th. Meanwhile, Scottish Field magazine has announced the winners of its annual Whiskey Challenge. The competition was to find the best new Scotch whiskies released since January of 2010. Glenglassaugh's Manager's Legacy release honoring Walter Grant led the top 10, followed by Lagavulin's Distillery Only Bottling. Gordon and MacPhail's MacPhail's Collection Glenrothes 1969 release was third, followed by a Connoisseur's Choice 1997 Kalila, also from Gordon and MacPhail. In fifth place, Duncan Taylor's Black Bull 40-year-old blended scotch, batch number 2, followed by the Cutty Sark 25-year-old and the Glenlivet Founders Reserve 21-year-old. Rounding out the top 10, the Benromic Origins Port Pipes release, the Rare Old Invergordon from Duncan Taylor, and the Naked Grouse. Look for the complete story in the July edition of Scottish Field. One final competition note, the James Beard Foundation announced its annual award winners this past week. The only whiskey-related award went to Julian Van Winkle of Old Rip Van Winkle Whiskey. Julian was named the Outstanding Wine and Spirits Professional of the Year. Congratulations to Julian. In other news, Bardstown's only working bourbon distillery now has a new name and visitors center. Sazerac has renamed the Tom Moore Distillery, which it acquired when it bought Barton Brands in 2009. The distillery will now be known as the Barton 1792 Distillery. It's known for the line of Barton whiskeys, including Very Old Barton, as well as 1792 Ridgemont Reserve Bourbon. By the way, the new visitors center may be a familiar spot if you've visited Bardstown in the distant past. It was the original home of the Oscar Getz Museum of Bourbon History. The museum moved into downtown Bardstown many years ago. It's almost time for the annual gathering of Peat Freaks on Islay and the Islay Festival of Malt and Music, and I use the term Peat Freaks with love, guys. During last year's special series of episodes from Fayshiel, we heard from Kevin Campbell of Lagavulin, who also coordinates the Pillaged Malt series of charity bottlings. Kevin emailed me this week to say the auction of the final series of Pillaged Malts has been completed. All 200 bottles of the whiskey vatted from casks donated by Tobermory, Jura, and Ardbeg have been sold, with a high bid of £335 or $543 for one bottle. Kevin says the bottles are safely in storage now until the labels arrive on Islay and should be shipped out by July to the winning bidders. Proceeds from the auction will go to charities on Mull, Jura, and Islay. Meanwhile, McTeers held its latest auction of rare whiskies this past Wednesday in Glasgow. A bottle of 50-year-old Springbank led the bidding at £2,200 or $3,565, followed by a 1945 Macallan at £2,000. The next McTeers auction is set for June 15th. There's a whiskey auction of sorts at New York City's Morell & Company this Wednesday, but the provenance of these whiskies may be of more interest than the whiskies themselves. That's because the U.S. Bankruptcy Court has asked Morell to handle the auction of wines and spirits seized from Bernie Madoff after the largest Ponzi scheme in history. Proceeds from the online auction will go to repay Madoff's creditors and his victims. A look at the catalog shows Madoff may have been more of a wine snob than a whiskey lover, but it could be fun to have a piece of Bernie Madoff's collection on your shelf just for bragging rights. You've heard me quote Scotch Whiskey Association spokesman David Williamson many times over the years. David is moving on now to a new post at the SWA, overseeing its efforts in North America and the Caribbean. Former Scottish Parliament press officer Rosemary Gallagher will be the association's new media relations officer. Finally, a quick correction and clarification from the last episode. I mentioned that Cooley's new Kilbeggan 18-year-old Irish whiskey was a blend of grain whiskies and pot still whiskey. I need to clarify that pot still whiskey is officially defined as being made out of a mash bill of both malted and unmalted barley, and is not used for blending with grain whiskey. What I meant to say was that Kilbeggan is a blend of grain whiskey from patent stills and malt whiskey distilled in pot stills. By the way, Cooley has been distilling its own pot still whiskey. Managing Director Jack Teeling told me this week that Cooley will be releasing a sampler version of it later this year. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well made. Before I get to the emails, I wanted to remind you about the free WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. Almost 18,000 people have now downloaded the apps. They give you wireless access to each week's podcast, along with the calendar of events and my tasting notes for more than 500 different whiskeys. If you're using one of the apps, I'd really appreciate it if you'd post feedback on it in the iTunes App Store or the Android market. That way other whiskey fans will be able to find out about them. The iPhone and iPad version is sponsored by the Glenrothes. The Android version is sponsored by Ben Romick, and we appreciate their support. Now let's check the emails of the week, brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. Caught some grief about the last episode, since I wound up staying in Ireland a day longer than planned. The show wasn't available for downloading until late Sunday afternoon. That interfered with what one listener refers to as his Sunday breakfast with Mark, and David let me know about it this week. David, I take cream and sugar with my coffee. Had some comments about my discussion with Dr. Bill Lumsden a couple of weeks ago about bottles turning bad after being exposed to air. Bill Ricker in Boston had this comment. I have heard that air in bottles changes some whiskeys far quicker than others, but no one knows which. I do like Dr. Bill's comment regarding danger of an open bottle absorbing ambient scents. I'll remember that, though I usually recork early and often. I am concerned about oxygen in a half-full bottle opening the recorked spirit's flavor compounds while stored. Since quite a bit of the chemistry of opening in the glass must be from oxidation, I am convinced this is at least a potential issue, even if not often observed. My policy for any opened bottle not being drammed frequently is to top up with vinophil nitrogen sold for just this purpose and seal the cork in with electrical tape to be double sure. And when a bottle gets too low, I decant into a miniature bottle topped off with nitrogen and wrapped with a photo of the original bottle. the tape and recant techniques I learned from Mike, my whiskey mentor and benefactor, the nitrogen I learned from Vinifields. Bill, those are really good suggestions. Ivo Fanati in Canada asked for some help with a vintage bottle of whiskey. Here's what he had to say. A friend of mine asked me if I can help him determine the value of a bottle of 1897 King Edward Scotch. It was given to his dad when he retired from the mines. Any information and help would be appreciated. If he wanted to sell this bottle, what would you suggest his best options to be? Love the iPhone app, Ivo. This is out of my area of expertise, but I suggested on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page that Ivo check with the folks at McTears and Bonhams, which handle most of the major whiskey auctions around the world. Whiskey magazine columnist John Rose also answers questions like this all the time, and you can email him through the magazine's website. If you have a suggestion for Ivo, go ahead and add your comments at the Facebook page, too. You can also start your own conversation there. And, of course, you can always email me directly with your questions or suggestions. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. And the emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. On the web at johnnywalker.com, where you can become a whiskey insider today. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. The Islay Festival of Malt and Music gets underway this coming weekend. Bonhams will hold its next whiskey auction May 24th in Hong Kong. Whiskey Live Madrid is May 26th. The Queensland Whiskey Expo is May 31st in Brisbane, Australia, where there will also be a Scotch Malt Whiskey Society members tasting on June 3rd. Woodford Reserve's final Bourbon Academy class of the year is June 11th at the distillery in Versailles, Kentucky. And finally, the Miner's Delight Inn in Atlantic City, Wyoming, will have its next second Saturday single malt tasting on June 11th. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Join the friends of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay. This week's WhiskeyCast In-Depth segment is brought to you by Auchentoshan. Last time around, we heard about two new Irish pot still whiskies from Irish distillers, including the Powers John's Lane whiskey. John's Lane in Dublin was the site of the Powers family's distillery for about 200 years. John Ryan is the patriarch of the Powers family now. He retired recently from Irish Distillers, but was on hand last week in Middleton for the launch of the Powers John's Lane. We sat down for a chat about his family's history and the changes in Irish whiskey over the years that led to the merger of Ireland's three big distilling families.
James Power founded the distillery in 1791, and his son, who became Sir John Power, made it big and successful during what I call the second golden age of Irish whiskey. And Sir John Power had five children, Sir John Talbot Power, Sir James Talbot Power, Sir Thomas Talbot Power, Francis, and Gwendolyn. The three boys all worked in the distillery. They all married. They all had children. But as luck would have it, their children died in infancy or quite young. The two girls, on the other hand, married Joseph R. O'Reilly, and my great-grandfather married Gwendolyn Power. He was Major General Thady F. Ryan, and the Ryans and the O'Reillys had copious children. And at the end of the 1890s, when Uncle Jim Power and Uncle Tom Power were worried about succession in what, after all, was a family business, they invited a number of their O'Reilly nephews and Ryan nephews to join them in the business. And among them was my grandfather, Willie Ryan, who was distilling director throughout his life, and his two sons, who are my father, John Ryan, John A. Ryan, and Clem Ryan, also came in. And then I was the seventh, and I'm sorry to say the final generation to work in the Powers business. I've got four daughters, and one of my daughters did work for a brief time in Spain selling Jameson after the Irish Distillers merger. But in fact, other than that, at the end of it all, I'm a dinosaur and the end of my line.
Which is sad to say, but you've got a lot of great stories to tell about you, not only your lifetime, but those other lifetimes of the seven generations before, or the six generations before you, right?
Yes, indeed. Powers was unique in a number of respects. First of all, Powers was the first distillery in the world to bottle their own whiskey. Up till then, whiskey distillers sold their whiskey in bulk to big merchants called whiskey bonders, who sold it then by the glass from the wood in the pubs of Ireland, or they bottled a small quantity or for their aristocratic consumers. But Powers realized that the quality of whiskey only became perfect when the maturing and the bottling was carried out by the distiller himself. So in 1902, Powers produced for the first time ever what was called Powers Gold Label, which was the distillery bottled whiskey. And over the next 50 or 80 years, this became the favorite of Irish people. And to this day, Powers Gold Label is the preferred brand in Ireland. And then in 1966, Powers and Jameson and Cork Distillers merged together to create the infant Irish Distillers. And this was really to relaunch Irish whiskey in the world markets. Irish whiskey had dominated before Prohibition in America and throughout the British Empire before Ireland left the British Empire and the British Commonwealth. Then we lost all those export markets. So 1966 was the time for relaunching Irish whiskey. And that happened. And I'm glad to say in the 40-odd years that have followed, exports of Irish whiskey, all brands, have gone from 27,500 cases to over 3 million cases, led primarily by Jameson, because that was the designated brand. But now, I'm glad to say, the other brands, particularly Powers, are growing in the umbrella effect of Jameson. And in fact, my dear friends in Pernod Ricard USA, who distribute Jameson and Powers in America, they've got a lovely way of describing Powers. They call it the weed. And we said, why do you call it the weed? They said, it keeps on growing.
You mentioned the second golden age of Irish whiskey. What was the first?
Ah, well, nobody really knows where it all began and who began it, but Irish whiskey probably goes back to about the 6th century AD, and probably Irish monks bringing Christianity to Ireland from the Middle East also brought with them an instrument which the Arabs had used for making perfumes called an alembic. And the Irish soon found a better use for it than making perfumes. And these Irish monks discovered that if you made a mash of barley and yeast and fermented it and distilled it in an alembic, you produced a wonderful elixir of life, which they called Uisce Beatha, the water of life. And Ireland's golden age of Christianity ranged from the 6th to the 9th century AD, when Irish monks kept Christianity alive at a time when the rest of Europe was in darkness. And then Irish monks brought Christianity back to Europe in the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries. And they also brought with them the Word of God, certainly, but also the art of distilling. And for me personally, as a whiskey distiller, one of the most fascinating parts of the whole story is that today in Europe, in every European country, the word in that European country's language for its own native distilled spirit is Uisce Beatha, the water of life. In France, it's eau de vie. In Germany, it's Lebenswasser. In Scandinavia, it's aquavit. In Italy, it's aqua di vita. In Spain, it's el agua de la vida. In Finland, it's elämänvesi. But you didn't know that one, did you?
I did not.
And they all mean Uisce Beatha, the water of life. So that was the first golden age of Irish whiskey.
Tell me about growing up around the old Powers Distillery in Dublin. Since it's no longer there, we can no longer visit. It's been redeveloped. There's nothing left of that distillery on John's Lane. Tell me about life back then at that distillery when you were growing up.
It was quite a Victorian institution, almost a paternalistic institution. They worked hard, the managers, the directors, and the workers, but they were respected each in their own way. And they did achieve great results. Powers was, let's say, one of the most successful of the great distilling houses of Ireland. And I certainly remember as a child coming in my mother's motor car to the distillery, either to meet my father or even to get a fill of petrol, believe it or not, because my mother could buy petrol from the distillery cheaper than she could from a pump in the main streets of Dublin. And in those days, the distilleries worked probably for 8 or 9 months of the year, rather than 12 months, because in those days, when you bought your barley at harvest time, you had to make whiskey with it during the next 6 or 8 months. And if there was any stock of barley left over in your warehouse come springtime, it would start to germinate, because you couldn't control the humidity and temperature. And so you really had to finish your distilling season by about April or May. And so the distillery was extremely busy for 8 months of the year and then silent for the 4 months of the summer. That I remember clearly.
And what was going on during those 8 months that you were involved in?
Well, I didn't start now until 1969, when I was a young 23-year-old. I joined the industry as an export man, because that's what the purpose of that merger between Powers and Jameson and Cork was in order to relaunch Irish whiskey in the world market. So I was one of the first young leg men in bringing the news of Irish whiskey back to the world. And finally, in those early days, and I worked in Europe to begin with, even Ireland was unknown in Europe. People in Europe said, Ireland, where's that? And then Ireland joined the European Economic Community in 1972. And that gave us a great leap forward. People understood where Ireland was, and we could explain to them about Irish whiskey. And gradually we sowed the seeds, initially through that lovely drink called Irish coffee. We sowed the seeds of Irish whiskey in general, and Jameson in particular. And then gradually people began to discover the pleasant taste of a non-peated, triple distilled whiskey, and the pleasure of drinking that on the rocks or with soda or with water. And I'm glad to say the result now is that Irish whiskey has definitely entered its third golden age.
And you mentioned Irish coffee. If I remember correctly, I believe Powers was the original whiskey used to make the first Irish coffees at Shannon Airport, right?
History isn't quite clear on that point. Today, certainly, Powers is the featured whiskey for Irish coffees at Shannon Airport. Nobody really quite knows for sure what whiskey dear old Joe Sheridan used when he first introduced the traveling public to the delights of Irish coffee. It might have been Powers, and I like to think it probably was, but I can't, unfortunately, put my hand to my heart and say it was proven as such.
Tell me about the day in 1975, which, although it had to happen for a number of good reasons, had to have been a sad day for your family, the day that the distillery on John's Lane distilled its final drops of Ushkabah.
Yes, well, that's a very, very valid point. The merger, as I say, took place in 1966. And it was actually my father, John A. Ryan, who was managing director of Powers at the time, and his younger brother, Clem Ryan, who was distilling director, who realized that there wasn't going to be a future for Irish whiskey unless we dug a hole and buried the hatchet of competition between Jameson and Cork distillers. And that was achieved in 1966. And the first objective then was to decide where the distilling should take place. And the old Jameson distillery, founded in 1780 on what was then the fringes of Dublin, was suddenly on the outskirts of Dublin. The Powers distillery, founded in 1791, also at that time on the outskirts of Dublin, suddenly in the center of this newly grown Dublin city, and so expansion was impossible. In Cork, we inherited two fine old distilleries in the middle of Cork distilleries, in the middle of Cork, and then one distillery at Middleton, County Cork, 13 miles east of Cork City, but with plenty of land around it. And so the difficult decision was made in 1973 to build one brand new centralized, not just a distillery. We call Middleton a distilling complex, a number of distilleries under one roof with the ability of distilling both Jameson and Powers and Paddy according to the traditional recipes. And having designed that in 1973, having commissioned that in 1975, the very difficult decision for my father's generation was then to close down the old Powers Distillery and the old Jameson Distillery and the two old distilleries in Cork City as well. A sad time, but a necessary reality for moving Irish whiskey into the 21st century.
But what was that final day like when there was no stopping it and everybody knew this was it? What was it like on that last day?
In a way, the pain was eased somewhat because Middleton was commissioned in September 1975, but as an insurance policy, the decision was made to continue distilling in John's Lane in Powers Distillery for one more season. So they went on distilling through till May 1976, just to make sure the Middleton worked properly. But throughout those 7 or 8 months, everybody knew, A, that Middleton was working properly, and B, that this would definitely be our last season. So it wasn't a complete sudden stop overnight. It was a final season, which brought John's Lane Distillery to a wonderful conclusion after nearly 200 years.
How does the spirit compare between that distillery on John's Lane and the Powers that comes out of Middleton today?
It's not very easy to answer that question. I think both the old Powers Distillery and the old Jameson Distillery produced a style of pot still whiskey which was appropriate for the early part of the 20th century but was increasingly out of fashion and was necessary to update it, which we have done very successfully with the current generation of new, younger, fresher, cleaner Irish whiskies with more of a lighter whiskey content to them, which is one of the reasons why Jameson has now reached a sensational sales peak of 3 million cases, 36 million bottles around the world, something which gives me, as an old whiskey distiller, an exceptional pleasure. I know at least that my pension is going to be paid for because of that. And the Powers whiskey of today probably bears a certain resemblance to the Powers whiskey of 50 years ago. But once again, it has been brightened, lightened, cheered up to a style which is more in keeping with today's consumer tastes. And the wonderful thing that's happened now, which has permitted us to launch again pot still whiskey in a 21st century context, is that having built Middleton Distillery and having commissioned it in 1975, the first 20 years was spent really playing catch-up, building enough whiskey stocks to ensure that the great growth of Jameson would not be lost for want of stock. But from about 1995 onwards, young Barry Crockett and the other great distillers were capable of putting new quantities of special distillates away into special casks, into special warehouses, knowing that they would be able to look on these when they matured as possible future harbingers of the new style of Irish whiskies in the future. And that's precisely what we have launched this weekend, the new style of pot still Irish whiskies, following the great tradition of the pot still, but in the modern style, which is so typical of the finest things in Irish whiskey.
And you've referred to this as possibly the third golden age of Irish whiskey. Why do you say that?
Well, in the bad days of Irish whiskey's nadir, which really were from the time of the repeal of Prohibition in 1933, exports of Irish whiskies had collapsed, and the future for the industry looked very, very bad indeed. And it was a matter of resurrecting the industry. And that's why that merger took place in 1966 with the single objective of relaunching, reintroducing, re-presenting Irish whiskey to the markets of the world. And as I say, my generation struggled for 20, 30 years sowing the seeds, which did not really come to fruition until the very recent past, when Jameson, as I say, has gone from virtually nothing to over 3 million cases in world trade. That I consider to be the third golden age of Irish whiskey, and who knows, there could be a fourth golden age around the corner.
Now, I have to mention one other distillery in there, because there was another distillery that was part of the original Irish Distillers, which has been spun off. Those folks up in Northern Ireland at Bushmills, which played a key role in the development of Irish Distillers, but had to be spun off for antitrust reasons a few years ago.
Yes.
Explain their role in the whole Irish Distillers merger and how that came to be, because they're on that English side of the border. And we all know from history that the Irish and the English, at least the Northern Irish, have not always historically gotten along, and that's putting it quite mildly,
yes,
but
no.
I'd like you to put that into context.
Okay. I'm glad to say that on many subjects, Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland have disagreed, but on the subject of whiskey, I'm glad to say we have always been very much in agreement with each other. It's much more important to be united over whiskey, and we were from the time the Bushmills first joined our family. Bushmills didn't join in 1966. What happened was that a famous man in the American liquor trade, Sam Bruntman, old Mr. Sam, saw Irish Distillers happening, came to see us in about 1970 and said, I like what you're doing with Irish whiskey. I'd like a share of it on a very friendly basis. I'd like to take you over. And we said, yes, thank you very much, Mr. Sam, but really we'd prefer to be independent. And we said to him, look, up there in the north of Ireland, there's the Bushmills Distillery. That belongs to an English brewing group called Bass Charrington. They've got no real interest in it. They didn't know what to do. Why don't you go to Bass Charrington and buy Bushmills from them? Don't tell them that we sent you, and bring it back, and then we'll talk business. And that's exactly what happened. Sam Bruntman bought Bushmills from Bass Charrington in 1972, brought it to Dublin, sold it to us, and in exchange we sold to him 15% shareholding in Irish Distillers Group. And Seagram owned 15% shareholding in Irish Distillers Group right through till 1988, when we joined the Pernod Ricard Group. So that's an important link, and a pride link that we have with the Seagram Company in that period.
And there is still some kinship with the folks up at Bushmills, even though they're no longer part of the corporate family, for lack of a better term.
I was personally very sad when we sold them off. And our time in our association with Bushmills was an excellent part of the development of the evolution of Irish whiskey in export markets. I personally was very, very sad when Bushmills had to be, shall we say, sacrificed on the altar, as you say, of antitrust. And I, for one, was miserable when it moved out of our friendship, and control is the wrong word, but as part of our team.
And you can't look at Brussels with a straight face because of the antitrust ruling.
Not at all. But I still have a great respect for the brand Bushmills, its individual categories, and respect for the distillery and the people who worked there. They were wonderful people. And the work we did with them was not in any way divided by the fact that they are from the black Protestant North and we were from the green Catholic South. Entirely irrelevant, I'm glad to say.
Tell me about that perception, because we in the States and around the world have heard this perception that people in the Republic of Ireland and the Irish Free State were drinking Jameson, Powers, Paddy, and the folks in Northern Ireland were always drinking Bushmills because it was the Protestant whiskey. Is that truly the case?
Not really. I think it's quite convenient on a shallow level to divide people that way, but it didn't really happen in that way. It was more a question of what one was used to. One thing which a lot of people don't realize was that in Ireland, when you go to a pub, even today in Ireland, you never hear an Irish man or an Irish woman ordering a whiskey or an Irish. It's always, I'll have a Jameson, give me a Powers Go Label, I'll have a Paddy and Water, give me a Bushmills. Always my brand. Why? Because each brand is subtly, delicately different from the other, and each Irish man or woman will defend with his dying breath his right to order his own brand, and no bartender would dream of serving anything other than the ordered brand, because the customer would sip it and say, hey, that's not my Jameson. And when we built Middleton Distillery, that was one of the great worries that faced us. Would we be able to produce Jameson that tasted like Jameson? Would we be able to produce Powers that tasted like Powers? Because if we failed, we were going to drown ourselves. We were going to go down the tubes in a matter of a couple of years. Precisely that happened, you know, to the brand Tullamore Dew back in the 1950s. Tullamore Dew had been a successful brand at home and abroad. And then in the early 1950s, 1951, 52, they managed to send out some bad batches of whiskey into the market. Nobody quite knows what it was or why they were bad, but the word went out in the early 1951, 52 period. The Tullamore Dew wasn't what it used to be. In a matter of about a year, the brand died on its feet in Ireland. And the Williams family, who owned Tullamore Dew at the time, also owned the highly successful Irish Mist brand. And they were selling Irish Mist overseas on the back of successful Irish coffee markets. And they used their stock of maturing whiskey to fulfill their Irish Mist needs. And they stopped distilling in the Tullamore Distillery. And when they finally ran out of stock, they sold the brand Tullamore Dew to Powers in exchange for Powers agreeing to supply them with whiskey, mature and new, for the Irish Mist brand. That's how Tullamore Dew came into our family.
And eventually wound up leaving the family as well and being spun off again for antitrust reasons, business reasons, and a number of reasons.
Just a bad mistake. I think we should have kept Tullamore Dew. I have a great passion for that brand. I used to sell it in Germany, and it pleases me mightily. I got it to number one brand of Irish whiskey in Germany, and despite all of our efforts at Jameson, Tullamore Dew is still the number one brand of Irish whiskey in Germany. I take a certain evil pleasure in that.
Tell me what you think. When you're driving through Dublin and you find yourself on John's Lane and going down through the neighborhood where the old distillery was, Tell me what goes through your mind when you pass by what was, to be quite honest, your family's birthright and your birthright.
Absolutely, yes. Well, the good side about it is that we managed to sell the premises, the 11 acres of buildings on the John's Lane Distillery site, to a most unusual client who is the current occupier of the premises, and that is the National College of Art and Design of Ireland, the NCAD. The NCAD had occupied premises in Kildare Street in Dublin, immediately adjoining the Parliament buildings, and the government wanted those buildings back, and they wanted a new home for the NCAD, the National College of Art and Design. So miraculously, their needs corresponded with our needs in the year 1980. And in 1980, we, with a certain amount of regret, sold the entire Powers Distillery site to the National College of Art and Design, who, as I say, occupy it to today. And just last week, I was in there doing some filming, and I'm glad to say that there used to be 5 magnificent copper pot stills in the still house in Powers Distillery. One of them, the smallest, I had moved 30 years ago from John's Lane down to here, to Middleton Distillery, to Old Middleton, and that is the one that is planted outside the front door of Old Middleton Distillery. That came from John's Lane. The other 4 pot stills were too big to move. And 3 of those 4 are still there, still extant. The building is no longer around them, but the 3 of the 4 pot stills are still there in the open air in the National College of Art. And they're much appreciated by the students as examples of, shall we call it, Victorian industrial art. It's nice to see them there.
Which is a nice touch, because there is no Powers Visitor Center or Old Powers Distillery or Old John's Lane or whatever you want to call it. But there is the old Jameson Distillery, but at least some of the old Powers plant lives on in those 3 stills, right?
That's true. The decision to concentrate on Jameson only was a difficult decision, you know, for my father's generation were to take that decision. But really it was quite a simple marketing decision. We'd merged together. We had 5 brands, like 5 horses in a race. We had the Jameson horse, the Tullamore Dew Horse, the Bushmills Horse, the Powers Horse, and the Paddy Horse. The race had already started. Jemison was the clear leader, and we could still bet in marketing terms. What do you bet on? You bet on the obvious favourite, which is Jemison. So since 1966, Jemison has received the vast majority of our marketing funds, and that's one of the results why it's achieved the sensational result of 3 million cases worldwide. But now's the time, now to invest smaller but more intelligent sums of money behind the more elegant, complex, interesting brands of the evolution of tradition, like the single pot still range that we launched happily this week.
And like Powers, for instance?
Well, yes, I will always have a personal passion for Powers, although I have to say in my export selling life, I probably sold 100 cases of Jemison for every one case of Powers that I sold. I hope my ancestors are not turning in their graves at the thought, but that's the commercial reality today. But it's wonderful to see Powers with a new lease of life and the reasonable possibility of remaining a firm success in Ireland and internationally.
Which one do you drink, Jemison or Powers?
Jemison when I'm working, Powers when I'm not.
Which is most of the time these days, right?
Well, I'm retired now, so I'm glad to say most of my elegant, quiet, personal drinking is with Powers.
If you could go back and change it, would you? And keep Powers as the preferred brand?
I don't think so. The commercial reality in 1966 was that there were strong vestiges of awareness in overseas markets of Jemison. There was no overseas vestige awareness for either Bushmills or Tullamore Dew or Powers or Paddy. So the decision was right in 1966. All of the marketing concentration had to be behind Jemison. So if we hadn't done that, we would have fallen between two stools and achieved nothing. So we definitely made the right decision. I remember my father saying to me, the first million cases will be the hardest. He said that to me in 1966, and he was right. It took us 30 years to get from 1966 to 1996. Actually, that's not true, 28 years. 1994, we hit the first million cases of Jemison, but the second million cases came in 8 years, and the third million cases came in 5 years. So that just shows a million cases was the hardest. After that, you're into big time.
I'd love to have a voice like that someday. Meanwhile, I reviewed the Powers John's Lane in the last episode, and you'll find my tasting notes for Powers Gold Label in the WhiskeyCast smartphone apps and at the WhiskeyCast website. This week's WhiskeyCast In-Depth is brought to you by Auchentoshan, the triple distilled since 1823. Visit the all-new Auchentoshan website on the web at auchentoshan.com. No tasting notes this time around. The pollen has been heavy and thick this week, and I've had the sniffles from allergies and couldn't really get my nose into any whiskeys. I'll get back to nosing, hopefully, in time for the next episode. In the meantime, you'll find links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed at the WhiskeyCast website, along with the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.